You're listening to Big Cast, your source for financial technology innovation with John Best.
Welcome to another edition of the Big Cast. My name is Glenn Sarvati. On behalf of the Vest Innovation Group, where, as hopefully you know by now, we like to do cool things with financial technology for credit unions and payment players and other folks in the financial space. We've got an interview today, starting off the year on the right foot, thinking about how to move forward. Carl Dahlgren, the Managing Director of Research at BAI, talking about their recent research of both consumers and financial institutions in their banking outlook and what that tells us about where priorities lay both for consumers and for banks, credit unions, and some interesting disconnects in a few of those cases that I think are very worthwhile to take a look at and think about how that might affect your strategy going forward. Before we jump into that, let me also, as always, mention that you can always find us online on the website of the Best Innovation Group, big-fintech.com. And if you go to the media tab there, you'll find all of our archives of past episodes of the Big Cast. If you're not listening through that media channel, you can go there also for show notes with a couple of details for resources that are related to the conversations you're going to be hearing today. And if you are listening elsewhere or want to continue to listen and want to get a prompt whenever we have new content, which is usually every Tuesday, you can also, if you are so inclined, we'd love it if you'd subscribe to the podcast, wherever you get your podcasts, Spotify, the App Store at Apple, Stitcher, et cetera, et cetera. Let me do, as we do sometime, a quick around the horn on some of the recent headlines in the payments and fintech space. I think there's, as has been the case for quite a while now, always lots going on. So we'll hit a couple of these before we get into our interview with Carl Dahlgren. The company Affirm, we've talked about them before, had their IPO a couple of weeks ago. The thing that's particularly interesting about this one to me is that they pulled back their IPO in December. Usually when an IPO gets pulled back, it's because there's some kind of a problem. Either there isn't enough demand for it, or there's some kind of issue with compliance or paperwork or something, and it's usually thought of as a bad thing. It looked to be the case this time, and it appears to have borne out, that that was not the situation with the firm. About the time they were looking to go public in December, there was a slew of other startup, or IPOs, I should say, that immediately upon going public popped big time price-wise and shot through the roof, having their valuation double or even more than that, which, you know, is very exciting for people and great for the investors. But if you think about it, for the company that's actually going public, that says that they left a fair amount of money on the table. And I think that's exactly what Affirm was thinking. That, okay, let's go back and figure out exactly what our company is worth and maybe go out when there's a little bit more stability to the marketplace, and maybe they can put some of more of that money in their own coffers. That appears to be kind of what they did. They did go public finally in mid-January. I believe it was January 11th or 12th. For perspective, back in September was the last time a firm raised money through private capital markets. At that time, the company was valued at $5 billion. Then in December, when they were looking to go public, it looked like the expectations were kind of around the $10 billion range of where they would probably go out. You know, that's a pretty nice increase for just a window of a couple of months there. And that's where they pulled back, because they were seeing a lot of companies that were going out were doubling basically overnight, as I said. So they wound up going out publicly again a little bit later after about a month's delay. The IPO price was in the 40s, and it continued to increase even as they were going through the process. They wound up with an IPO price that valued the company at $12 billion, again, compared to $5 billion and $10 billion just a few months earlier. And so they banked another $2 billion, another 20%. Can't complain about that. Here's where it gets really interesting, though. The same thing still happened. The same, you know, pretty much the next day, their price still doubled when they actually started trading publicly on the exchanges. And it wasn't a one-time shot that wound up dropping back down either. They are now, at the time that I'm recording this, have a market cap in excess of $29 billion, which would be basically six times where they were in September. And if I had, if Ryan really felt ambitious, but let's not bother, but I'm just thinking of the song from the 19-teens, I think it was, I'm Forever Blowing Bubbles. Let's leave it at that. Anyway, a good company. I'm not saying anything about that, but the valuation seems just a little weird. Visa and Plaid, another big valuation company, and another interesting story. $5.3 billion was the price tag that Visa paid to acquire Plaid last year, or was announced they were going to acquire Plaid. Then the Department of Justice got involved and said, not so fast. We think there might be some anti-competitive concerns. Got interesting there. And, you know, who knows where you take that from there, that $5.3 billion being set before a lot of this noise that I mentioned in the fourth quarter. Well, lo and behold, the announcement was made this past month that they've called off the marriage. And Plaid will continue to go its separate ways. One of the interesting things here, again, is typically when something like that happens, there's a breakup fee that's paid of someplace 5, 10, 15, 20% of the purchase price because of usually what's considered to be the harm that's done to the company being acquired, having basically been cast aside, looks like damaged goods, winds up back in the marketplace on its own. The reports are there was no breakup fee paid in this one. Not really clear exactly what, everybody's saying all the right things, everything's great, really happy to be a standalone company, et cetera, et cetera. And there's a variety of schools of thought of what may have happened. I'm of the school of thought that says, okay, the Department of Justice had raised objections. They looked like they had some pretty good dirty laundry about some of the things that were said in emails about potentially taking out a competitor at the Visa side. Maybe they didn't want that getting out there. But at the very minimum, it meant, you know, usually what these things wind up happening is the acquisition will go through, but not without a lot of Sturm und Drang and maybe some other kind of compromise measures and concessions being made to divest of something or guarantee not to, you know, make certain changes or something like that to satisfy the DOJ. That's my belief, that I think that the headache of basically being gummed up and spending millions in legal fees in the meantime and potentially slowing down market evolution was probably just more trouble than it was worth. I've heard people also on both sides of the equation saying Visa realized they could probably get a better price later on, less than $5 billion. I've heard other people say, yeah, you know, Plaid's more than happy because they probably can get more than $5.3 billion. So who the heck knows? But the bottom line is Plaid continues to be a standalone public company. Another thing I'll just throw out there is be interesting to watch if they may eventually go public again through a SPAC, a Special Purpose Acquisition Corporation, which I'm assuming most of you have been following along is the hottest new kind of end-around way of going through an IPO. And something that we'll probably spend a little bit of time talking more about. Great article on that, really laying out the details in the Saturday Wall Street Journal. That would have been, I believe, the 23rd, January 23rd, if you're interested. Big feature write-up on that. Another piece of current news, the departing head of the Comptroller of the Currency, the OCC, Brian Brooks, was never actually formally installed. He was always the acting head, but now leaving. And was also affectionately, or not so affectionately, referred to sometime as the controller of the cryptocurrency because he had such a fascination with digital assets. His parting gift before he left was he actually issued the first national trust charter to a digital crypto-focused bank, Anchorage Digital Bank, N.A., for the purposes of safekeeping of digital assets. Specifically, the terminology was the safekeeping, management, and trading of digital assets. This may not be quite as big a deal as it sounds because one of the things that's pointed out, and I think this will get lost in the rounding or the comprehension of a lot of people reading this, these will not be FDIC insured. They are not accepting deposits. They're really playing more of a trust safekeeping type role there. Safekeeping and not being deposit insured is an interesting kind of nuance there, but so it may not have quite the impact that some people are reading into it, but it's still very, very interesting stuff. You may also remember a couple of other banks that already received charters, Kraken and Avanti, very specifically digitally focused institutions. Those are a little bit different. Those are special purpose depository institutions, and they were both chartered in the state of Wyoming because of an initiative going on over there. They will be in a separate exercise looking to acquire FDIC insurance. That's a separate application process. So more to come on that. New head of the OCC coming. Interesting stuff. Also on the regulatory front, Kathy Craninger is leaving the CFPB, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. I had speculated earlier, I believe on this podcast, that I thought that Kathy Craninger might have a little bit more tenure to go, that I did not think that the Biden administration would put that as one of its priorities. I was wrong. They have cleaned house there. Kathy is moving on. There will be somebody new at the helm. And the appointee that they are intending to bring in is Rohit Chopra. He was one of the original assistant directors at the CFPB and was one of the first hires that Elizabeth Warren made. And his focus has been historically on student lending, so the suspicion may be that that would be his area of focus in his role at the head of the CFPB. Again, my thought is there are other areas of importance that I thought the Biden administration would put some additional kind of elbow grease into at the early stages, but it might be easier to just kind of do everything and start with a clean slate up front. But the fact that this is somebody who is tied closely to Elizabeth Warren at the beginning, I think may speak to the fact that we may be seeing a little more activity out of the CFPB and a change in direction than I had initially suspected in the early days. However, from a financial institution and credit union standpoint, if it's focused primarily on student lending, that probably is a lot different than having to worry about Dodd-Frank and the Durbin Amendment and things like that, which I continue to believe will probably be a little bit further down the road. Finally, one more. Walmart, as you probably saw, has announced that they have partnered with Ribbit Capital out in Palo Alto to start up a fintech venture. Not a lot of details on this one. Walmart will have majority ownership, and the idea is that it's a combination of the retail expertise and knowledge of Walmart and the fintech expertise and knowledge of Ribbit Capital. Again, not much more said than that in terms of exactly what they'll be going after. I'm sure we'll have a lot more to learn and follow along with over the course of the next year. Walmart obviously has already been involved in multiple fintech ventures at varying degrees of success. I'll put this one in the camp of, you know, watch this space along with Google checking, which obviously is a big initiative, but not terribly well understood and kind of kept under wraps. So we'll see where this one goes. In terms of a lot of people turning to Walmart as, you know, a trusted agent to actually provide financial services. And hold that thought, because we're going to come back to that at the end and revisit, because it actually ties to some of the conversation here with Carl Dahlgren, which I'll jump into right now. As I said, he's the managing director of research at BAI, and I'm still old school. I still think of BAI as being an abbreviation for Bank Administration Institute. It's not. They're now like NACHA, where they had a former acronym that now just doesn't stand for anything. It's just BAI. And one of the reasons is it's not just for banking anymore. They do a lot of education and other work in terms of supporting other financial institutions and fintechs, including credit unions, as Carl will talk about a bit. As I said, it's the annual banking outlook they do. A lot of interesting stuff in it, and let's just get to it. I'm here with Carl Dahlgren. He's the managing director of research for BAI, that institution I'm sure you're well familiar with. Carl, thanks for taking the time and sharing some thoughts on, I guess this is an annual research study that you've done for some time on bank expectations for the coming year.
Yeah, hi Glenn. Thanks for having me. Really appreciate it. We do. We have what we call BAI, Banking Outlook, and we survey bankers as well as credit unions and various different financial institutions, including fintechs. And we also survey consumers. There's actually, you know, roughly 4 to 6 of them a year, but the outlook for the following year is an annual event. Yes. Yeah.
And I think you made a really good point there too. This is a survey. There's a consumer component we'll talk about as well. We're going to kick off first with the piece around financial services providers. But it is, I think of the legacy going back in time. I've been in the space long enough of BAI being banks, but there are, as you say, credit unions and fintechs included in the sample of what the attitudes that we're seeing, right? And that's part of the overall ball game here.
Correct. We cover the entire financial services industry, and you know we provide a number of services and information to financial service leaders. So credit unions are a big part of our focus. In particular, we've got a learning and development business that provides compliance training, and we have a library built around credit unions and many credit unions that utilize that product, as well as a lot of our thought leadership.
Great. Good to know. And frankly, I was not aware that you were quite as involved in the credit union space. That's great information. And of the sample you've got here, would you say it's representative in terms of the spanning the different asset sizes across institutions in the U.S.?
Yes, it is. We actually make sure that that's the case. And that's one of the questions we ask, so that we have, you know, we're not overly biased one direction or the other.
So it is a representative sample, community, regional, large banks, et cetera. Great.
Correct.
So, you know, the first thing, and this is not rocket science by any stretch of the imagination, but obviously it's good quantification and, you know, kind of confirmation of what we know. The customer digital experience, it was important in 2020. It's going to be important in 2021. It's at the top of the list in terms of where bankers are, you know, seeing their investment priorities and business challenges. The part that I find really interesting, though, is if you take the next level down, and this is where you start juxtaposing bankers and consumers, as I see it, on your list, is the perception of the ways that the customer experience can be improved. And it looks like the consumers have, at the top of their list, something that didn't make the banker's top three, which I find really interesting.
Yeah, I mean, it is sort of, I mean, first of all, everybody knows that, you know, we're in the midst of a pandemic, and we moved to a touchless economy, and that meant that several of the financial services industries had to shift on a dime and, you know, leverage their digital channel when they closed down some of their physical locations. And, you know, so that's made a big difference to the industry.
And they've reacted quite well in 2020. I mean, the turning on a dime, I think they, you know, given the stereotype of banks not being the fastest moving, I mean, necessity, the mother of invention, they really went and got it done.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we may be getting ahead of ourselves here, but I mean, we've got some data that we've provided that the perception of the financial services industry is quite good. And it's been affected positively. It's a silver lining, honestly, with the pandemic, that they've reacted quite well. And, you know, if we think about what's happened over the course of the last 12 months across multiple industries, there's been sort of what I'd call sort of supply chain issues, right? Because demand went near to zero in some areas, and then, you know, the demand went super high in multiples, honestly, in other areas. And it's really hard for businesses to make those kinds of adjustments. So, for instance, shutting down your branches and, you know, ramping up, say, for example, all the operations associated with PPP, you know, that's a big change operationally, particularly for bigger organizations. And, you know, customers are, I mean, they're not that there hasn't been hiccups, but, you know, the data that we have shows that, that folks are thinking equally as good about their financial services industry or better than previous to the pandemic. So
I noticed. I mean, there's no reason to stay, you know, linear. It's a kind of open-ended conversation, but that was definitely one of the things that jumped out at me from the data that I saw is net, I mean, there's more people who have a more favorable impression, you know, as of now than last year, than there are people who had their impression of their financial institution decline. So
yeah,
that's a great positive.
So, just to comment on your original question here, you know, we've talked to financial service leaders and consumers and asked them, you know, what would they rank top to improving customer experience? And there's two things that in the top three that rank in the top three for both categories, right? The consumers and the financial service leader, and that's making better use of data for product services recommendations, and also improving the omni-channel experience.
And both seem intuitive to me. I mean, I can see why those would definitely rise at the top of the list.
Yeah, I mean, you know, improving the omni-channel experience has always been an issue, right? Making sure that information that's provided in one channel is accessible to the other channel, and you can pick up in one channel where you left off in another. And a lot of that has to do with systems, right? You have to integrate systems, and that doesn't happen overnight. And there's been a lot of good work done there and some gains. And of course, that was stressed a little bit, right? Because if you move to digital, that stresses that sort of integration piece. So that remains very important. The thing that was different was, as you mentioned, for consumers, give me tools and options to customize my own solutions.
Yep.
Versus the financial service leaders were still focused on enhancing the mobile channel. And the mobile channel has been very important. I think partially one of the reasons why it might be very practical why this was the outcome that we received. But what you find is that consumers are quite happy with their mobile channel experience. In other words, they rank it very high. They like what they have. On the other end, you ask that same question. Actually, we asked these questions right next to each other in the survey. The willingness to move for a better feature has gone up. So customers are less sticky. And I think that, you know, the financial service leaders are aware of this, and maintaining customers is a very important goal of theirs. And so while the consumers aren't saying, hey, we need better mobile experience, the financial service industry knows that if they don't keep up, they'll lose the customers. So I think that's partly an explanation of, you know, the difference there. The other thing is that there could be some generational things playing here. So as you spread this out across sort of Gen Z through Millennial X and Boomers, you know, Gen Z, they want faster payments and automated tools and things like that. And Boomers and Gen X, they want, you know, fraud and identity theft. So, and a lot of that has to do with, you know, your financial needs as you move through different life stages. And obviously you, you know, in general accumulate wealth over the time of your life. So you're more focused on protecting it as you get older versus, you know, less sophisticated needs that are required mm-hmm. when you're younger. So if you mix that all together, that causes some distortion in the data as well.
Yeah, I mean, it really caught my eye. You've got a 4x4 grid here that has the four, you know, demographics, Gen Z up to Boomers, and you've got the top four about, you know, what they're looking for their financial services organizations do to help manage their money. And it's interesting to me, it's a pure stair step straight up. Fraud and identity is, I mean, number four. It's not like it's the bottom of the list. It's just the fourth most important for Gen Z. And it goes up one notch all the way through to Boomers, where it's the top piece. Which
Glenn, I mean, if you weren't going to use the words stair step, I was going to. I mean, that's exactly how to describe it. You know, in terms of the top four ways in which financial services organizations can help their consumers, Gen Z ranks at four, Millennial three, Gen X two, and Boomers one. So it stair steps right up as you go through the different generations. And I think that has a lot to do with, you know, what your financial needs are, right? So for Gen Z, they want faster payments. They want to move the money around. They have less sophisticated needs and they need access to the cash right away. And Boomers are looking to protect. This fraud thing has really become an issue too, just because, as I mentioned earlier in our interview here, you know, there's overnight adoption of digital, and more digital means, you know, potentially more fraud, right? Because it's hard to know who's on the other end. And so fraud is a big issue. And honestly, in another survey that we did, again, banks and credit unions and financial service organizations are performing well. Customers think that they're getting, you know, those that have experienced fraud feel that their financial services industry has handled it quite well. But the issue is, even though the financial services organization is not the one that's committing the fraud, obviously, you know, the way in which they handle that is very important, because they don't want to be sort of have the negative experience a consumer has spill over onto the bank's brand. And
they're the ones holding the bag. They're the ones that have, you know, at least in the customer's eyes, the opportunity to fix it.
Whether
it was their fault or not. Yeah, and I definitely, that's the other thing that I picked up here. There's a question about, over the course of the last 6 months, again, broken up by demographic, has your, you know, concern about fraud increased, decreased, stayed the same? Net, in every category, you've got more people who have become more concerned about it than less. And the thing that catches me is the group that really jumps out is more than half of millennials say that their concern has increased. And to me, that's one of those things where I think... Maybe it's just me because I'm, you know, older than a millennial, but I still think of millennials as relatively young. But at the end of the day, millennials are at a stage of life now where they've got to start worrying about that kind of stuff. They do have wealth accumulation.
Yeah, I think that's a very good point. They're getting to the point where, you know, their financial needs are more sophisticated. They do have more wealth. They're more concerned about it. I think there's a cross section here too of two trends. So, If you look at millennials, and this is based on some other questions that we've asked, millennials are far more willing to provide information online if they feel that that information is going to somehow benefit them in sort of customized or tailored product offerings and things like that. So they're less guarded online than say the older generation. They're more equipped and used to using online channels, so that exposes them a little bit more.
And,
so,
and they're waking up to the fact that there's something of value that's being exposed. So I guess that
right.
that kind of ties together. That makes sense.
Yeah. I mean, there's more information. They provide more information out there, so it's more likely that the incidence of it being breached is, you know, versus the older generation, which is, you know, more guarded. So I think it's just it's a cross section of that. They provide more information online, and their financial service needs are getting more sophisticated. And between the two of those things, they're experiencing more fraud, and as a result, are more concerned about it.
Interesting. Another question, kind of on the demographics. I mean, faster payments, and you've talked about this already. The need for faster payments. Payments, quicker transfers, access to money. That ranks as the number one objective and thing that they're looking for both Gen Z and millennials. I don't know if this is a fair question. I don't know if you've gotten to this level of detail. Do you know what they mean by faster payments? Because I think about, you know, faster payments as defined by, you know, RTP as offered by the clearinghouse or FedNow that's going into production, looking toward, you know, real-time transfer of money. In my mind, a lot of it is really just posting and availability. At the end of the day, the consumer doesn't care if the actual money went through the rails as long as they have access to it.
Right. Well, that's a good insight, and I think we're sort of venturing into the area of insights versus the precision of sort of questions asked around this. But I, you know, if you look at it from the financial services perspective, there's risk, right? If you make funds available before they've cleared, you're obviously that puts you at risk.
Mm-hmm.
And the consumers, they don't care whether or not, you know, the mechanics of how it gets settled and how quickly or whatnot. They just want access to their cash. And I think that's generally the case for younger generations, right? Because they just have less of a buffer
mm-hmm.
of wealth,
yep.
So they need access to their money. And there are people or organizations, on the fintech side that have played to that need. So, for example, Chime, right?
I know they made big publicity, a big PR gain by making the stimulus checks available early.
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly right. Now, it has less to do with the mechanics of how it clears and more to do with just making it available. And so they're taking some risks, you know, calculated on their part from their perspective. The question is, you know, how does that... You know, how do you manage that risk, and is it economically viable over the long haul? I think that'll, you know, play out over time. But they're clearly going after share with that kind of feature and a particular generation.
Yeah. So we touched on this a little bit earlier too. I mean, with the branches having been closed and people adopting digital, I mean, there's one school of thought that could say people are going to say, "Yeah, guess what? I really don't need the branch anymore." But the data you're seeing actually doesn't seem to back that up. I mean, across all demographics, there's a good solid, you know, half or more of the consumers that say, "I prefer to bank where I have access with branches, even if I don't use them very often." And then there's another group that also still says, "Yeah, I want to keep a checking account, at least as a backup, at a place with branches, so I always have that option." So is that kind of your thinking about the way to read this out, that branches still play an important part in the overall equation?
I think that's absolutely true. There's a couple of things to think about here. First of all, to sort of dispel a common thought, which is that the older generations are used to using branches and want the physical location, and so it's more important to them versus the younger generations don't. And I'm referencing some BAI Banking Outlook survey questions that we've asked in the past here, but what you find is that the younger generations use drive-ins and branch actually more than boomers, but they actually use every channel more,
mm-hmm.
right? So
I've heard that, and I'm looking at the numbers, and yeah, there's not a material difference between the branch kind of perceptions of Gen Z even versus boomers. Yeah, it's weird.
I mean, the one thing that we do kind of, I mean, that's interesting here. That's one dimension. The other dimension is what's happened because of the pandemic, mm-hmm. right? So if, you know, we asked a question, prefer to bank with a direct bank that does not have branches, right? So a new and different kind of model. And if you look at that across Gen Z, Millennial, Gen X, and Boomers, in 2019, respectively, the way that played out was 17%, 20%, 16%, and 4% answered, yes, I prefer to bank with a direct bank that does not have branches. And then after, you know, the pandemic had began and things moved to digital, those numbers went from 17, 20, 16, 4 to 33, 25, 27, and 10. So every single generation was there was an increase in preferring to bank with a model that does not have branches.
And again, chasing rates. They're willing to trade off. I mean, the way I read it is the rates are more important than, you know, if you think there's any, maybe they don't even believe there's any inconvenience, but if there is some, it's worth the trade-off.
Yeah, and I think they were forced to actually use the digital channel, and when they were forced to do that, because, you know, they probably had some history or habit of not doing that, and they were required to do it, and they said, okay, this isn't as bad as I thought, and it's actually quite convenient. And so so what's happened is the pandemic actually, I would say, pulled forward certain trends that were happening already and accelerated them. So it has actually benefited disproportionately the model without branches. So they've been able to make some gains. Now, that said, let's return back. You know, if you look at the actual percentages, and by the way, people are more willing to do more complicated things digitally, right? Mm-hmm. So at the beginning, it was kind of like, you know, look up your balance, make a few transfers, so on and so forth. But now there's like applying for loans and mortgages and things like that. And there's and we've done some survey work pre and post pandemic, and as there's been some inroads on more sophisticated type activities occurring in the digital channel, more sophisticated transactions happening in the digital channel. So, you know, consumers are just getting used to it. But that said, I mean, like you said, there's still 50% of the people there say, I'd rather do this in a branch. And while, you know, people, there's this term new normal that everybody's using.
Yeah.
You know, we generally believe that there will not be a snap back to baseline, right? So there's going to be some continuing trends. In fact, we've asked that question of consumers, and, you know, the majority of consumers have increased their digital usage in terms of financial services organizations, and the vast majority expect to continue using that additional usage. So certainly it's not going to snap back to normal, but there's still a large portion of the population of consumers that want to have that face-to-face. And we do some benchmarking, which is that we actually get data from banks and credit mm-hmm. unions, and then help you know, folks look at how they're performing relative to their peers. And there's information in there regarding sort of online applications, and you're already seeing a readjustment. So like right after March, the percentage of applications skyrocketed online, and then there was a reduction. In other words, the percentage of applications started to come back towards the branch after that initial sort of, you know, early spring mm-hmm. problem. And then there was some reopening with masks and social distancing and things like that. And people did return to the branch. Now, it didn't snap back to normal by any means. But what that does show is there's still a percentage of people that want to, you know, have access to a person and a friendly face.
Well, it's kind of funny. I mean, hearing the way you described it, it's, you know, it's funny that in some ways it says what's happened is the boomers are going to start behaving more like the Gen Zers, because now that they've become acclimated to using digital and discover it's doable, they're going to keep it in their arsenal of ways to go about things. It'll be part of their toolkit, but they're not going to drop the, you know, the branch. So as you said, the Gen Z, they just use everything, and maybe it's going to be the boomers doing the exact same thing.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you know, the issue with the generations that use everything is that's quite costly.
Right? Yep. Well, and again, I didn't mean to overstate. I mean, I'm not saying, oh, the branch is fine, don't worry about it. You know, I'm thinking about it by the same token of the way people think about e-commerce, because the percentage, that the size of that group that says they prefer to work with a direct bank, at the end of the day, you know, for all the noise, and it's obviously, you know, e-commerce is biting into brick and mortar even before the pandemic. That size of that population is about the same as our overall population in terms of, you know, the share of e-commerce compared to brick and mortar commerce. And if it's growing at the same level, you're going to wind up in the same place. That's still pretty important.
Yep. It's an important trend. You know, as financial service leaders are making choices, you know, it's good to keep your eye on what's happening.
Yep. So this is great stuff. If people want to find more, Carl, with BAI.org, I can post the broader link. Is there a specific place where they can find a little bit more on the research that you do and some of these outputs?
Yeah, go to BAI.org. And then there's various, go to research within that page at the homepage, and then look for BAI Banking Outlook. And there's more information regarding that.
Wonderful. Well, I appreciate you taking the time. Carl Dahlgren, the Managing Director of Research for BAI. Great stuff. I'll be watching for the next output as well.
Wonderful. Thanks for having me. Really appreciate it.
Thanks again to Carl for that conversation. As I said, I wanted to come back to something, and I did touch on this a little bit in the session. I got some additional information after the fact from Carl. The level of trust in terms of the question of what companies would you most trust to handle your financial products and services, big drop-off. Primary financial institutions still head and shoulders above everybody else, but a significant drop-off between 2019 and 2020. What didn't make a lot of sense to me is if I look at the other players just below, they didn't change. PayPal, Amazon, Apple, all gained in, you know, the level of trust that consumers were thinking of. Particularly PayPal made a significant gain, which is definitely important to be watching for. But there was clearly, based on what I was seeing, some other players, because the top four didn't add up to as big a percentage as it has in past years. Sure enough, when we followed up, there are a couple of other folks lurking beneath that top four that made significant gains, one of which was Walmart. Still only 4%, but that's, you know, a growing number of consumers who think of them as who they would trust the most. That's the exact wording of the question, to handle their financial products and services. Google in the mix on that as well. Again, we talked about Google checking, so that plays in. And the other one that surprised me in that same mix, and they're all kind of in the 4, 5, 6% range, was Facebook. With all the other noise around Facebook, I would not have expected that. But again, it's another digital player, and the fact that they're still in the mix there with a subset of the demographic being very interested in looking to them for financial services, something to definitely watch out for. So again, thanks to Carl for taking the time to talk. And as I said, we'll post on the website, big-fintech.com, in our show notes, a way to get to some more information on this if you want to follow up with BAI. With that, another episode of the BigCast. My name is Glenn Sarvati. You can find me on Twitter at my firm's 154 Advisors, at 154 Advisors. You can find the Best Innovation Group on FinTech on Twitter at Big FinTech. And as I said already, on the web at big-fintech.com. We'll be back with more new content next Tuesday. Until then, thanks as always for listening.
Got a question or want to join the conversation? We'd love to hear from you. Tweet us at Big FinTech, email us at info@big-fintech.com, or visit our show notes and comments at www.bigfintechmedia.com.